Across the Pacifica network and over 60 community stations, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 14, 2003. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, I'm Kata Mester. The Bush administration suffered a setback in its efforts to win a second United Nations resolution authorizing war with Iraq. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of asbestos workers who fear cancer-related symptoms. This as Congress again writes liability relief legislation for companies that make asbestos. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
The time has come to move beyond entrenched positions and to take concrete actions to achieve peace.
President Bush today announced that he will unveil a roadmap for peace for the Middle East.
The government of Israel, as the terror threat is removed and security improves, must take concrete steps to support the emergence of a viable and credible Palestinian state, and the Arab states must oppose terrorism, support the emergence of a peaceful and democratic Palestine, and state clearly that they will live in peace with Israel.
Violence surged in the region in the last 24 hours. Awad Duwabis reports from Ramallah.
In the Jenin refugee camp of the West Bank, the Israeli army killed five Palestinians, saying they were armed activists. A local Islamic Jihad leader said four of them were activists, but he said they were sleeping when they were attacked and killed by an elite unit of the Israeli army. Last night, another five Palestinians were killed in the village of Tamun near Jenin. The five civilians were shot dead during an Israeli raid in the village. All over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the Israeli forces demolished 24 Palestinian houses in what Israelis call preventive security measures and Palestinians call collective punishment. This comes at a time when Palestinians are proceeding with the appointment of their first prime minister. I am Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
The U.S. military moved two Tomahawk destroyers from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea amidst growing signs Turkey won't participate in the war on Iraq. Aaron Glantz reports from Kilsiltepe, Turkey.
Newly elected Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan surprised many by telling reporters in Ankara today he wouldn't schedule a new vote allowing U.S. forces to invade Iraq from Turkey until March 21st. Erdogan also sacked his predecessor's foreign minister, Yasser Yakish, the architect of the deal parliament turned down March 1st, greenlighting the American troop deployment in exchange for billions of dollars in grants and loans. Popular protests continued against the war in Turkey, with Greenpeace protesters locking themselves to U.S. military convoys docked at the Mediterranean port of Iskenderun. Military convoys have been leaving from Iskenderun to the border with Iraq without parliament's permission for more than a week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Kızıltepe, southeastern Turkey.
The LA Times reports that a State Department document contradicts the Bush administration's confidence in creating democracy throughout the Middle East after the war against Iraq. From D.C., James Cullum.
According to the Times, a leaked State Department document entitled Iraq, the Middle East and Change, No Dominoes, was sent out to a small group of top government officials. It says that the success of President Bush's so-called new domino theory for democracy in the Middle East has been secretly called into question. The domino theory, fashioned after President Eisenhower's vision of the prevention of communist expansion, works on the principle that if democracy is enforced in an American-controlled Iraq, then other regions will follow suit. The theory has been one of the president's main arguments for going to war against Iraq, but the document says that anti-American sentiments could lead to the rise of Islamic-controlled governments hostile to the U.S. and that, quote, daunting economic and social problems are likely to undermine the stability in the region for years, let alone prospects for democratic reform, end quote. The intelligence official who read the report to the LA Times characterized the thrust of the document, saying that the idea that the U.S. is going to transform the Middle East and fundamentally alter its trajectory is not credible. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
Two Albuquerque public school teachers, suspended for refusing to remove anti-war posters from their classrooms, are awaiting a hearing to decide whether they can continue teaching. Jeremiah Luria Johnson reports from KUNM.
Rigo Chavez, spokesman for the Albuquerque Public Schools, would not say what the circumstances were around the teachers' forced leave. However, Adan Baca, a counselor at the school, says the teachers were placed on leave because they refused to take down anti-war posters they had hung in their classrooms. The teachers, Carmelita Roybal, who teaches English, and Heather Duffy, who teaches art, could not be reached for comment. Jeff Sullivan, one of four principals at the high school, would not release details on the teachers or on their situation. He did say that the school acted on parental and community complaints. 45 students walked out of class Thursday morning to protest the teacher's suspensions, then returned to class after one period. Later in the day, another group walked out. Four of them were arrested for disorderly conduct. The teachers, Roybal and Duffy, will remain on paid administrative leave until APS Human Resources decides on their cases. The charges could be dismissed, the teachers could be docked pay or possibly fired. Hearings on the case begin next week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremiah Luria Johnson.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The Bush administration has suffered a setback in its efforts to win a second United Nations resolution authorizing war with Iraq. A majority of Security Council members made it clear they wouldn't support the measure, forcing postponement of a vote President Bush insisted would be held this week. At an emergency summit this weekend, the administration's and its closest allies will decide whether to pursue diplomatic negotiations or withdraw the resolution and launch an attack within days. But as Susan Wood reports from the UN, there may still be a way to halt the drive towards war.
A total of 9 yes votes and no vetoes from the permanent members of the UN Security Council are what the U.S. needs to pass its resolution, which sets a deadline of this Monday for Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to prove he has disarmed. Yet last night, after weeks of arm-twisting among the 15 Council nations, the U.S. was forced to admit only 3 other countries support the measure: Britain, Bulgaria, and Spain. France and Russia showed no signs of backing down from their pledge to veto any resolution authorizing the use of force. French Ambassador Marc de la Sablière said progress was being made towards disarming Iraq through UN inspections.
We think it is really possible to disarm Iraq through peaceful means in a period of time which is not very long. It's up to the inspectors to tell us how long, but we understand that it would be only months. So the question put to us and the question asked by people in the world is why go to war if the job can be done peacefully in a limited period of time?
A British proposal requiring the Iraqi president to pass 6 tests to avert war, including a television appearance renouncing weapons of mass destruction, failed to win majority support. Some council members indicated they found the request humiliating. Meanwhile, 6 uncommitted nations said they were developing their own proposals that would not include a trigger for war. One of those countries is Chile, whose vote the Bush administration earlier claimed was in the bag. Marcial Godoy Anadivia is a Chilean graduate student at Columbia University. Godoy says that sentiment has only increased with the recent revelations of U.S. spying on U.N. diplomats.
And the more that this drags out and the more revelations there are about spying and the more the further phone calls and visits from Otto Reich to Santiago, the more that this will cost the Lagos administration if it does indeed vote yes.
Another country that has proved resistant to U.S. pressure is Guinea, which currently holds the rotating council presidency. The West African nation, 65% Muslim, has a history of anti-colonialism. Guinean-born Siba Grovagi, a professor of international relations, says public opinion is solidly anti-war, and a pro-U.S. vote could undermine peace.
Politically, it would be a very bad thing, because we've had civil wars in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and now we have troubles in Cote d'Ivoire, and all these troubles have been about a struggle for democracy. So to encourage countries at this particular moment to defy public sentiment would be very, very troubling.
Faced with what looks like certain defeat for its resolution, the Bush administration is now considering withdrawing it and claiming it has the right to invade Iraq on the basis of Resolution 1441, which authorized more intrusive inspections. Some legal experts say there's still a way the UN could act to prevent war, by reviving a 1950 General Assembly resolution called Uniting for Peace. Marjorie Cohn is a San Diego law professor and vice president of the National Lawyers Guild.
The Uniting for Peace resolution, which has been used 10 times since 1950, says that when the Security Council is unable to act because of a veto or because of a deadlock to maintain international peace and security, that the General Assembly can act.
Such an initiative requires the support of more than half the General Assembly, but Cohn says this week's open Security Council debate, called by the non-aligned movement of mostly developing nations, shows most countries are opposed to war.
So Russia and Germany and France and China and other countries, I believe, would have the votes, if indeed they are pursuing this path, to agree to send UN peacekeeping troops into Iraq to police the inspections and, in essence, to keep George W. Bush from bombing.
In another indication of the world's deep concern, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said he has received a proposal from Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to convene a summit of world leaders to seek a way out of the crisis. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Frustrated with their failure to gain support in the UN for an invasion of Iraq and facing overwhelming condemnation from the world public, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair today changed the subject. Both leaders gave speeches calling for a two-state solution in Israel and Palestine, but both governments continue to threaten the use of force on Iraq. In the U.S., even mainstream Democrats have begun to dissent, as anti-war marches are planned in cities worldwide this weekend. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
For months, they've had a full-time focus on disarming Iraq and/or regime change, threatening to use nuclear weapons, even allegedly spying on U.N. member states in order to coerce their votes. But the elusive coalition of nations willing to support an invasion of Iraq has failed to materialize for George Bush and Tony Blair. This morning, they switched lanes to start talking of a two-state solution to the Palestine-Israel problem.
The nation of Israel has a new government, and the Palestinian Authority has created the new position of prime minister. Israeli and Palestinian leaders and other governments in the region now have a chance to move forward with determination and with good faith.
Minutes later in London, Prime Minister Tony Blair dodged questions on the Iraq issue to also focus on Palestinian statehood.
Well, let me just deal with the issue of the timing. I think it's precisely now that we have to say to people that the issue of peace between Palestinians and Israelis is as important as any other issue to us.
Reporters pressed Blair to explain how he thinks it's possible to negotiate a two-state solution with the hard-right Ariel Sharon government. Blair said a long-awaited U.S. so-called roadmap to peace would encourage Sharon to end the military occupation of Palestine and withdraw to year 2000 borders. The Palestinians call for withdrawal to 1967 borders.
In terms of actually moving the peace process forward, I don't see a whole lot to this, frankly.
Stephen Zunis is the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. He says the sudden change of topic from Iraq to now Israel-Palestine is intended to help Blair and Bush recover some of the support they've lost in pursuing Saddam Hussein while appearing to ignore the Palestinians.
This is an effort to shore up domestic support and perhaps give a little something to the small Arab sheikhs that have been providing some logistical support for the war to show the United States really is still concerned about the situation.
Blair and Bush and Prime Minister Aznar of Spain will meet in the Azores over the weekend to make what they're calling a final push for a resolution authorizing the invasion of Iraq. The White House has declared many times the U.S. can go it alone if the U.N. won't go along. Back in the U.S., where Congress last year abdicated its constitutional authority to declare war, a handful of moderate Democrats now say publicly they're against the invasion idea at this time. Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy on the Senate floor last night.
Instead of persuading the dissenters at home and abroad, the administration, by its harsh rhetoric, is driving the wedge deeper. Never before, even in the Vietnam War, has America taken such bold military action with so little international support.
Americans will take that message to the streets this weekend. Mara Verheiden-Hilliard speaks for the Answer Coalition, which is helping coordinate the marches.
Tens of thousands of people will be coming out into the streets of Washington, D.C., meeting at the Washington Monument at noon on Saturday. There will also be actions in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and in cities around the world. This is a movement that reflects the depth and breadth of America, from the women's movement, from the civil rights movement, from the religious community, from the lesbian, gay, bi, trans community, fighting together because we oppose a war in Iraq.
The Answer Coalition represented the U.S. in London last weekend, where anti-war activists from 28 countries met to coordinate this weekend's events. Josh Chaffin in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
At least 10 people died, 8 of them women, when a bomb blew apart the segregated women's first-class car and a general compartment car while in the station at Mumbai, commonly referred to as Bombay, yesterday. Thursday was also the anniversary of serial bomb blasts which targeted financial centers in the city 10 years ago. With these latest deaths and violence, Indian women had little to celebrate last weekend on International Women's Day. Despite laws, campaigns, and a vibrant women's movement, India is still a dangerous place for women. The National Crimes Records Bureau said the growth rate of crimes against women would exceed the population growth by 2010. India's pernicious dowry system, once known as an exclusive Hindu and upper caste phenomenon, and blamed for much of the violence against women, has now become truly universal, cutting across caste, class, ethnic, and religious barriers. Sputnik Kalambi has more.
Dowry system is leading to domestic violence, and it is the major cause for the violence against women.
Kalamani, who works on gender issues at the Hyderabad-based World Solidarity Center, underlining the point that the Dowry Prohibition Act, first passed in 1961 and amended significantly since to make the law more stringent, has changed little on the ground. Not a day passes without another news report of a woman dying a violent death, most often at home. Death is usually described as an accident. Sometimes cases are registered. Most times there is no follow-through, let alone punishment. And almost always the deaths are related to demands for dowry, often years after the marriage took place. Small wonder that one respondent to a dowry survey said she regretted not having killed her daughter at birth. Bringing a baby girl into the world in India is fraught with danger. A recent survey by the All India Democratic Women's Association showed the system has permeated every section, class, caste and religion. The denial of equal property rights to women, stresses Kalamani, is the crux of the problem.
Land reforms have come, but they are not being implemented properly. Women have property rights, but it is not being given. The society attitude has not changed, that women need not have property. Only men should have property. Women can study, but they should get married and go. These kind of deep-rooted social values are there. We have got very good laws, but the implementation part is really a failure.
It is no accident, say activists, that this has coincided with the neoliberal economic policies implemented during the past 1.5 decades. Dowry has in fact become a necessary precondition for marriage. It enables a man to buy his way into some means of earning a stable income. And since an unmarried woman is still a contradiction in terms in India, the no dowry, no marriage fear is widespread. And in the process, says feminist activist Rukmini Rao, women have become a medium of transfer of resources from her parental family to her husband's.
There are not enough opportunities for men to earn money in an honest way. So you end up with men looking at women as a source of primary capital. I would call this primitive accumulation of capital, just to use jargon, you know.
And what is worse, she says, is that this has spread to previously egalitarian societies, like amongst India's tribal population.
Once development comes, you get schooling for boys, no schooling for girls. You get dowry. Traditionally, tribal societies have actually a culture of bride price, where the bride is a valued person and the husband's family has to give a token gift or a sum of money. Whereas now that practice has become completely a turnaround, with the girl's family having to produce huge amounts of money.
Dowry is not only a bride killer, but also a major contributor to son preference. The All India sex ratio bears grim witness to this, around 920 women for every 1,000 men. According to a recent survey, almost all crimes against women, including female feticide and infanticide, are linked to the practice of dowry. If poor people kill baby girls off at birth or sell them off, the more affluent classes abort the fetus with the wrong gender, a grim spin-off of globalization and the access to technology. Kalamani again.
There are no livelihood sources today. They are forced to come to cities and they are working in construction sites or in somebody's house as domestic servant or in some landlord's estate. So the livelihood sources are really disappearing. And all these things are being taken away by corporate sector or private sector.
Activist Rukmini Rao slams the government for failing to implement laws that protect women, but stresses there is no shortcut to community mobilization and a real empowerment of women.
What we have found is that once the women are organized in small groups and have some opportunity for self-development, reflection, thinking about their own lives, they have taken very strong positions against killing girls and they have taken very strong positions against selling babies.
I'm Sputnik Kilambi reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
In a 5-4 decision Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court said asbestos workers can collect monetary damages based on the fear that they'll get an asbestos-related cancer, even if they don't yet have the disease. Dissenting justices argued that awarding the damages might dry up funds for those who can get sick later, up to 40 years after exposure. In coming weeks, Congress will once again try to write liability relief legislation for companies that make asbestos. This comes after revelations that a planned EPA emergency declaration about asbestos insulation in U.S. homes was nixed by the White House last year. The warning concerned a particularly deadly form of asbestos mined in Libby, Montana. That's in an estimated 15 to 35 million homes nationwide. Lee Robartis has more.
Of my extended family, 65 members now have been diagnosed, everyone down to 45 years old.
Like many of her relatives in Libby, Montana, Gayla Benefield never worked in the mine. It doesn't seem to matter where you once worked in Libby, where already more than 200 current or former residents have died of asbestos-related diseases. Benefield's x-rays show a scarring of the lung lining, usually a precursor to asbestosis or mesothelioma, which is cancer of the lung lining. EPA regional toxicologist Aubrey Miller says regular asbestos is deadly enough, but the Libby fiber is worse.
It seems to become more severe, more rapidly, that people are becoming more disabled, and the disease seems to take a different course.
In fact, Dr. Alan Whitehouse, a pulmonologist who has treated 800 asbestos patients of all types, has reported Libby asbestos is 100 more times as likely to cause mesothelioma as the more common chrysotile asbestos. Libby asbestos is common enough. Marketed for decades as a do-it-yourself insulation called Zonolite, the EPA estimates it's in 15 to 35 million homes in more than 30 states. Daryl Scott of the Lukens and Annis law firm in Spokane, Washington, is a leading attorney in a nationwide class action suit.
It's an equitable case seeking to prevent future personal injuries, and it is a present case for actual property damages to people who have the misfortune of having Zonolite in their home.
Scott believes the shiny gray insulation that resembles popcorn can be a time bomb.
That material, unless people are warned, will in fact be disturbed, and then there will be very high levels of airborne asbestos exposure.
The EPA was set to warn people in April of last year, but the public health declaration never came.
What stopped EPA from following through with its plan?
Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington took to the Senate floor last month to ask why homeowners and workers haven't been warned.
Well, Madam President, the answers might lie not with the EPA, but with the White House Office of Management and Budget, OMB.
OMB and its Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, the OIRA, has for some time served as a filter for all regulatory action by the government.
Neil Pattison, the Congress Watch Research Director for Public Citizen, says the OMB has not answered Public Citizen's early February request for an explanation why the emergency declaration was blocked. But an investigative report by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch found that the OMB's Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs derailed it. The OIRA is run by John Graham, former head of the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis.
And Graham's office in particular, and Public Citizen is on record as saying this, has acted more or less as an industry advocate to prevent regulations from taking effect.
The liability could be enormous. More than 15 billion pounds of vermiculite was shipped from Libby to 750 plants around North America. Now companies that have made asbestos products, already swamped with billions in health claims, want reduced liability. The American Bar Association recently recommended health guidelines for determining whether an asbestos victim can sue. ABA President Alfred P. Carlton says for people who aren't sick yet but have medically observed indicators that they might become sick, the guidelines allow them to preserve their claims without going to court.
Right now, the courts are clogged with claims, and a lot of really sick people aren't getting their claims heard.
Proposed liability reduction legislation has yet to take shape, and observers like Neil Pattison of Public Citizen fear industry may have an undue influence on final language. History gives reason for them to be cautious. Asbestos-producing companies have been heavy campaign contributors for decades, Vice President Dick Cheney's former employer Halliburton among them. In 2000, Halliburton contributed $150,000 to members of Congress who sponsored or co-sponsored controversial asbestos liability legislation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis.
The new Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan will have his hands full in the coming days, not only with Iraq, but with the recent collapse of UN-brokered peace negotiations between Turkish and Greek Cypriots. The Turks rejected a plan to unify the island proposed by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Even so, the European Union says it intends to move forward to admit the island nation of Cyprus. Izgi Sirataj has more on the failed unification talks.
Since the Turkish Republic of Cyprus was formed 20 years ago, its economy completely depends on the Turkish economy, an economy in crisis. Last attempt by the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan to unify Cyprus has failed in the Hague meeting on Tuesday. Galip Yalman, lecturer in the Political Science Department at the Middle East Technical University in Ankara.
Always the formula was in terms of two separate communities coexisting within the confines of a single state. Now the significance of Annan plan is that this geographical separation would be subjected to change, albeit in a prolonged way, not immediately if the parties agreed to the Annan plan, but more importantly is that increasingly, although there would be on paper two separate states, nature of the relationship between those two entities within the confines of a single state would be always subject to disagreements, because the nature of the relationship of a future unified state of Cyprus had been on the debating agenda nearly for the last 25 years.
President of the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, Rauf Denktaş, who has been ruling over the northern part for 20 years, is accused by both the President of the Republic of Cyprus, Tassos Papadopoulos, and the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan of not compromising. But Turkish nationalists favor Denktaş policies, saying he aims to keep the Turkish part's integrity. Emin Çarıkçı, from the Central Committee of Turkey's biggest nationalist party, MHP, talks about Annan plan.
Annan planı ise bir taraftan Rum tarafından.
Annan's plan includes the immigration of 80,000 Greeks to the northern part. Surveys made on both sides show that 80% of Greeks and 90% of Turks do not want to live with each other. This is because of historical conflicts. The Turkish population is only 200,000 people there. Placing 80,000 Greeks means placing a bomb.
Oraya bir saatli bomba konmuş oluyor.
The anticipated full membership of Cyprus in the spring of 2004 generates hot debate. The EU has voiced that Turkey would be in the position of an invader of European land and would affect the potential membership of Turkey to the EU. Many demonstrations are being organized by the Cypriot Turks to call for peace and the small Mediterranean island, an Annan's plan, which they say will enable them to be a part of the EU. What do the Turkish Cypriots think about the subject? Meltem has immigrated from Cyprus to Turkey 3 years ago.
Although it is not reflected in Turkish media, I think there will be a social crisis in northern Cyprus soon, as there is a great demand from people for peace. I want peace too, and I see the European Union as only a step towards peace. Maybe we will become instruments of the great powers when we become a member of the European Union, but now our situation is no better than that.
European Union Commissioner for Enlargement, Günter Verheugen, said that the best solution for the problem is the unified state model, and he accused Turkish military of not supporting that solution. It is now hard to foreshadow what is going to be next. But it seems that it is not possible to find a solution unless both of the parties make some sacrifices. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Izgi Sirataş in Ankara, Turkey.
And thank you for listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Katamester, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez.